Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Middle East Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Asad, one of the co-hosts of the channel and your host for our conversation today. Our guest today is Alex Dika Segerman, and we'll be talking about her first book, Modernism on the Nile, Art in Egypt Between the Islamic and the Contemporary. Dr. Segerman is an assistant professor of Islamic art history at Rutgers Newark University. She received her PhD from Yale University in the history of art, and she has held postdoctoral fellowships at Smith College, Hampshire College, and Yale. Dr. Segerman's work explores modern Islamic art history, and specifically the intersections between the modern and the Islamic. She has done research on Middle Eastern art movements and currently teaches courses on the art and architecture of the Islamic world, global and modern contemporary art, as well as representations of gender and sexuality in and of the modern Middle East. Her book analyzes Egypt's modernist art movement through the late 19th century up until the 1960s and demonstrates the interconnectedness of this movement with a constellation of art movements outside of Egypt. She also argues that the diverse major Egyptian artists of the era that she studies, while they may have appeared to be secular, they in fact reflected the subtle but essential inflection of Islam as a faith, as a history, as a lived experience, all in the overarching development of Middle Eastern modernity. Based on extensive research in Egypt, Europe, and the United States, her book presents a compelling argument for the importance of Muslim networks to global modernism. Without further ado, I now welcome Dr. Alex Dika Segerman to our podcast. Welcome, Alex. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So, Alex, as you may know, here at the network, we always begin with a biographical sketch of our authors. Could you share a little bit about your journey and what led you here? Why modern Islamic art history and why this book?
That's a great question. And there's always so many different ways to tell one's scholarly trajectory. So I was an undergraduate at Columbia during 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq in 2001 and 2003. So I was also an art history major there. So it was very kind of, while I was studying art history, there was a lot going on politically, both in the United States and around the globe. And I got increasingly interested in the Middle East and in Islam and took many courses there. And in particular, I was motivated to do that because my grandfather was Muslim, an immigrant from Albania, and that had always just kind of been like a very normal, uneventful thing in my life until those really important political, global political events in the early 2000s. So that kind of spurred me to study this part of the world, and I saw there was a really big gap in the scholarship about modernity in the Middle East, and that is what eventually brought me to Egypt to write this book.
Well, thank you for that, Alex. I'd like to begin with a question on methodology and framework. Now, you take great caution in how you frame your study of Egyptian modernity and Egyptian modernism, words that we're going to unpack later on in this interview. So you ground your work in the discipline of history. And lately, we're beginning to see a quote-unquote a global turn in history, generally speaking, including in art history, of course. Scholars are now attempting to account for non-European or non-Western histories. But in your book, you oppose the term global. You argue that the term still carries the subtext of non-white and non-Western. And at the same time, you also take issue with the term transnational, which is also another emerging popular term in the discourse. And so the expression that you use, and that if listeners caught it early on, was constellation or constellational. You say that art history or modern Egyptian art history was part of a constellation of artistic modernisms of the time. You say this term is less than global, but more than transnational. And so I was wondering if you could explain your critique of global and transnational and why you prefer to say constellational instead.
Is a really important framework for the book. And I was really searching for something that really clearly articulated and described the phenomenon that I saw occurring in Egypt's modern art movement over a 100-year span. So because I wasn't focusing on one artist or one decade, it was really a very large span of time. It was rather challenging to find a way to characterize the movement over about 100 years. So I toyed with the idea of global and transnational, but in terms of really characterizing the specificities of this movement, neither of those words seem to be able to express what exactly was going on. Global is a very helpful word, and I'm not saying that it's not a good word or that it doesn't have, clearly it has a place in the scholarship. And I definitely see my book as being part of global modernisms, which is the current name for the subfield. But even in that, global modernism, global is really what it really means in that construction is non-Western, non-European, or non-white. So even though globe ostensibly encompasses the whole globe, in that construction, what you're really referring to is things that are not in the current Euro-American canon of modernist art history. So it's kind of a tricky word. And it also, I think it also kind of evokes this idea of like the internet today, this extreme interconnectedness all over the world. And that was really not what was going on in modernism in Egypt, which had much more finite connections between artists, artworks, and art institutions. So transnational is another word that has been used a little less so in art history, but definitely within the humanities more broadly. But I found that was actually a little bit too limiting for the artists and the artworks that I was working on, because it really privileges the nation state and sovereign structures of dictating how people move between places. And that didn't really work either, because I had some artists who, like Abdelhadi El-Ghazar, he goes to Italy on government scholarship to study there. So he's, you know, transnationally going from Egypt to Italy. But then when he's in Italy, he skips out on his classes, kind of gets in trouble because he starts traveling to London, Florence. He goes to Munich. There's this great picture that I include in the book of him outside a Gauguin exhibition in Munich. You know, so he's breaking those official routes and going to other places. So I chose constellational because it defines both the finite connections that these artists and artworks had. You know, they weren't connected all the time everywhere. It really says, like, well, they went to like these particular spots and they reference these particular things. And then it also is part of my argument that those maps of connections are actually in the artworks. So it's not just that Ghazar went to Italy and then Munich, but that he tells us in his artworks and he makes it visual in the artwork that that those are the things that he wants us to recognize. So that is why I tried to hone in on this idea of constellational as the uniting characteristic of this modernist art movement, which I know definitely pertains to Egyptian modernism. And my goal is to develop this framework so that it could hypothetically be applied in other contexts.
Thank you for that brilliant explanation. I guess as a follow-up to that, I wanted to ask how you frame, quote, Islam and, quote, Islamic in your book, because those are also important terms that you deploy. And I was wondering if you could clarify your approach to them and how you bring these categories to bear into conversation with the Nahda movement of the time and with Arab Islamic modernity of the mid-19th century, more broadly speaking.
Okay, that's a really gigantic question. So I don't know if I feel like that might just require another whole book to answer it. So to begin with, you know, how I frame Islam and Islamic, because of the current divisions within subfields in art history, modern Egyptian art, and this isn't, so I know this is specific to art history, so there might be some listeners out there from other disciplines, and every discipline has its own special weird way of dividing its subfield. So in art history, we have Islamic art history, and we have modernist art history. And modernist art history focuses on the 19th and 20th centuries, mostly from a Euro-American perspective, a Paris-centric perspective. And this is currently being reworked, and the reinstallation of the Museum of Modern Art has made little inroads to complicating that traditional narrative. And then we have Islamic art history. So Islamic art history is a subfield of art history and has very particular boundaries and connotations. And Egyptian modernism and modernism in broadly has not been included in that story of Islamic art history. So it's important for me to pinpoint in the book that, you know, while Islamic art history has these very particular parameters, we need to at least ask the question, you know, does modernism from the Islamic world deserve a spot? Does it fit within this larger category? And that idea of Islamic art is very different from the Islam as an idea, as a religion, and as a lived experience that the artists that I study engage with. So as I note in the introduction, none of the works that I look at in this book are devotional. None of them are used for religious practice. Occasionally, they'll have an overt religious idea or story. For instance, in the work of Abdelhadi El-Ghazar, he has a painting of Zuleika, which is a, you know, direct reference to religious figure. But other than that, you know, these artworks are not religious artworks, and I'm not claiming that they are. However, they do reference the religion of Islam and the daily practice of Muslims in the contemporary context of Egypt that they were living through. So I detail very specifically in the introduction that we need to engage with, you know, we need to question how these artists were engaging with Islam and really understand that it is possible for the artist to think about Islam, to talk about it, to reference it without being dominated by it. Like these artworks are not characterized by that's not the main defining characteristic of this artwork. It's not a modern Islamic art movement, but they do engage with it, just like modernist art practitioners in Paris and New York are also engaged with the histories of religious painting, because they're in that history. So they're all artists, you know, are engaging with these different religious traditions, particularly when they're engaging with iconographies or visual traditions associated with those religious traditions. And we need to question that and engage with that and understand that, like, it's in the middle. Like, it doesn't have to be one or the other. It doesn't have to be secular or religious. It can kind of reference religion but not be defined by it. And so that is how I frame Islam and Islamic in the introduction. So would you like me to also, you had a second part to that question, but
I think that part, well, we're going to get to that throughout the interview. I really appreciate that you gave us the methodology and the framework, and now we can have a better sense of where we're going on this journey, because now I want to move on to the nuts and bolts of the actual substance of your book. And so in just starting out with your first chapter, you describe how the Egyptian modern art movement became established outside of the traditional centers of modernism. And you say that, you know, through the processes of modernization, the structure of Egyptian art was altered, in that it wasn't only produced and consumed by the elite anymore. And to use the term that you use in the chapter, you say Egyptian art became diagonal, in that it rejected, a teleological development originating in either modern or Islamic art history. And it was neither fine arts imported from European painting and sculpture, nor wholly born from local Islamic art. And you identify a few interesting people who sort of led this shift. You know, Princess Nazli Fazli, Yaqub Sanua, Sheikh Muhammad Abdu. And so I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about how this Egyptian art movement, through these individuals and others, became established outside of these traditional centers.
Yeah. So getting back to that, you know, that kind of at many points in the book, I'm grappling with the traditional 20th century narratives of modernist art history, because they're really embedded in the methodology of art history. So there's, you know, these Eurocentric narratives of artists going from Courbet and Manet to Van Gogh, Picasso, Kandinsky to Pollock, that kind of very clear teleology, it really has influenced art historical methodology. So at many points in the book, I kind of grapple with, you know, how do we unstick ourselves from that very powerful narrative? And one way that Egyptian modernism also really has the power to innovate not only what is included in the narrative of modernist art history, but also how we do that art history, the methodology of that, is that it really doesn't come out of this straight line of development in painting or development in sculpture. That first chapter where I talk about Princess Nazli Fazil, who was she wasn't an artist per se, but she took lots of photographs of herself and had a cultural salon in Cairo. Yaqub Sanua was a satirical illustrator and journalist, and Sheikh Muhammad Abdu was a religious scholar who talked about painting and sculpture. So these are kind of like the diverse makers and cultural producers of the 19th century that definitely don't, you know, they're not painters who then go on to influence the painters of the 20th century. They're dealing with a diversity of visual and material culture. For instance, photography was very important in addition to prints like lithography and engraving, and not the ephemera of material modernity in the 19th century was really formed the basis, as I argue in the book, formed the basis for the modern fine arts movement of the 20th century.
So I want to ask you now about Mahmoud Mukhtar, and I want to move the conversation from here up to Egyptian nationalism and how that developed through some of his artwork. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about who he was and what sort of artistic styles he drew from and how his work had significance for the development and the promotion of Egyptian nationalism within Egyptian modern art?
Yeah, Mahmoud Mukhtar is the most famous sculptor of 20th century Egypt. He has a museum dedicated to his artwork in Cairo today and designed by a famous architect, Ramses Wissawasef. So that, you know, it's still a place that you can go and visit today. And also his major monument, Nahdat Mas, Egypt's Reawakening, is a major sculpture that is still very much a potent symbol in contemporary Egypt and very much visible today. It's right outside Cairo University. So he came from a agricultural family in the Nile Delta, and he moved with his mother to Cairo as a young boy. And part of his importance or role as a modern artist in Egypt is not only his artwork, but also this very important myth-making that he and his biographers and his critics developed about him. So there's this very, very well-known narrative about how he used to form sculptures out of mud on the Nile tributaries in the Nile Delta. And he was kind of this prodigy who was making these small sculptures from a year early age, like right out of the land of Egypt. And he, who knows if that's actually true? It's repeated over and over by all of his biographers. And it's really, I mean, it's like one of those facts that would be almost impossible to figure out if it was actually true, but it is important. And that becomes part of this myth of his upbringing and how he came to be this really important sculptor. So he went to he was one of the first students at the New School of Fine Arts in Cairo, which opened in 1908. So the same, right around the same time as Cairo University opened, Prince Yusuf Kamil, who was a wealthy prince of the royal family, opened this art school in 1908, and sculpture was one of the areas of study there. And then Mukhtar graduated at the top of his class, and because he did, the prince sent him to Paris. So he went to Paris, and from 1912 to 1914, was in the studio of Jules Félix Coutin, who was a prominent academic sculptor in France who actually designed the sculptures that are outside, that are on the facade of Grand Central Terminal in New York City, which is kind of a cool factoid that connects us to this history. So Mukhtar, you know, he's really embedded in this academic training, French academic training. And part of that French academic training was that you studied from live nude models, and you also studied from classical sculpture. So they would have nude models come to the studio, and they would also study Greek and Roman sculptures. So because he was Egyptian, the other classmates at the school really associated him with ancient Egypt. So when he was in his days at in Cairo, he made these little sculptures that had more to do with contemporary Egyptian society. One little sculpture called Ibn al-Balid, which is, you know, boy of the country, just kind of like the boy of the street. And then he had another one named Khalwa bint al-Azwar, named after a female Arab fighter in the early days of Islam. So he had these kind of more references to Arab, Islamic, Egyptian histories. But when he went to Paris, he immediately got associated with ancient Egypt. So he began to bring that more into his artwork. And with Nahdadmas, Egypt's Reawakening, he brings in that image of the Sphinx into the artwork, and also the image of the peasant, which by that time had become a very important nationalist symbol. And so, as I argue in the book, he's not only participating in this nationalism, but he's producing it, and he's giving the Egyptian populace a way to visualize that nationalism, to visualize the anti-colonial sentiment that had been the impetus for the 1919 revolution and those protests, and producing a new visuality for this new nation state.
So now let's talk about the other Mahmoud, Mahmoud Sa'id, the Alexandrian oil painter. His art, you say, portrayed Alexandria's cosmopolitan ladies and gentlemen, nudes from the lower classes, and stylized landscapes of the world outside Alexandria. And you use these three sort of genres to trace his work: portraits, nudes, and landscapes. And as I was reading this, I was wondering how, you know, issues of class and race and gender came to bear on his work and how his work was received. And you pointed out that his work also signified a transition between colonial to post-colonial Egypt. And so I was just wondering how that process played out through Mahmoud Saeed.
Yeah, Mahmoud Saeed is a weird one. He is one of the most, both of these artists, but Mahmoud Saeed in particular has become very, very hot on the art market, and his paintings have been selling for very high prices at the auction houses like Christie's and Sotheby's. And just a couple years ago, a catalog raisonné, really gorgeous catalog raisonné, came out on Mahmoud Saeed, which basically has all of the paintings, all of his paintings and drawings that he ever produced. That's what a catalog raisonné is. It could kind of collect all of the paintings and drawings ever produced by an artist. And so, you know, he's really very popular. His paintings are so attractive. They're really lush. The oil painting is very thick and vibrant, and they depict these, you know, very beautiful and alluring scenes of, you know, wealthy people in Alexandria or lush Lebanese countryside, or and then also these very, very seductive nudes. And so they're really overly sexualized. The bodies in the nudes really kind of, there is, at least the last time I was there at the Mahmoud Saeed Museum in Alexandria. So Mahmoud Saeed's family lived in a villa in Alexandria. And when his family left in the 1970s, they gave the villa and all the paintings to the state. And so now the museum is in the villa that his family once lived in. And there was a room in there dedicated just to the nude paintings. But there's this kind of weirdness. There's a really stark divide between the portraits of the elite community in Alexandria, lawyers, architects, other artists, and wealthy women, both in his family and extended family and others, who really don't, their bodies kind of really dissolve or disappear underneath their very luxurious clothing. And then there's a stark divide between the whiteness that he's really developing, this elite Mediterranean community connected to France and Italy and other Mediterranean locales. There's a contrast between that and the nudes, who most often have darker skin than the people in the portraits. And so this chapter was really trying to work that out. You know, why did he do that? What exactly is going on, and why are they so overtly sexualized? And so I interpret them through a visual, in-depth visual analysis, that they evince a kind of fear of the fecundity, of the fertility, or the power of those lower classes, of the indigenous classes, who often had darker skin than the upper class community, who were often descended from the Turkish elite of the 19th century. So that there's this fear of the rising indigenous classes, and this is an important time for Egyptian art, because we're going to start seeing the artists moving away from participating in that French academic painting, which was not only important for Egypt, but was important worldwide. Artists all over the world were kind of looking to Paris, looking to the French academic painting tradition as a point of reference. We're going to start to see the artists move away from that to other sorts of visual and aesthetic techniques after the 1952 revolution.
So bringing this back to our discussion of, quote, the Islamic, I wanted to discuss the return of religious symbolism on modern Egyptian art, specifically through the work of Abdul Hadi al-Ghazzar, whom you mentioned earlier in this interview. You dedicate a chapter to his work. You write that mystical symbols like the hand of Fatima and al-Khidr allowed Ghazzar to express an anti-colonial Egyptian identity and a knowledge of the post-surrealist search for truth in local mystical spaces, end quote. And that during his time, the market even required him to be both national and international simultaneously. And these identities, in fact, upheld each other. Could you briefly touch on this for us?
Yeah, so this is a really important point in the book, especially vis-a-vis that discussion of, you know, what makes something is part of the subfield of Islamic art history, and maybe how that diverges from how certain artists are actively engaging with Islam as an idea or as a religion or as a lived practice. So here, Ghazar is in works like The Green Man, in which he references the Hand of Fatima and Al-Khidr, as well as works like The Story of Zuleika. Again, that is referencing a religious story. He's referencing those traditions, but he is absolutely not engaging with what we would traditionally think of as Islamic art or visual culture. There's no Thuluth calligraphy or geometric design or minarets. There's none of those sort of what we might see as visual indicators or visual symbols of Islamic art, stylistic indicators of Islamic art as defined by the Euro-American Academy. So in this way, he's moving towards religious references, but he's really doing it with as a post-surrealist move towards the mystical, which, as I mentioned in the book, also occurred in other places in the world. For instance, Wilfredo Lam, who is a modernist painter from Cuba, around the same time starts. He was part of the surrealist movement. He knew Picasso. He was working in between Paris and Cuba, and he starts to incorporate images of Santeria into his paintings and his work. So in a similar way, both these artists are using the lessons of surrealism, this turn to the unconscious, the insane, the childlike. They're adding the mystical to that as a way to search for truth through art. And so Ghazar was part of a art group called the Contemporary Art Group. And they had specific statements in which they wanted to return to an art that was more accessible for the masses, that talked more about Egypt specifically, to move away from the elitism and the Parisian centrism of the previous decades to something that was more authentically Egyptian. And one way he does that is by blending these surrealist ideas with references to local mystical traditions. And then that way he's really demonstrating that constellational modernism, right? So he's referencing these very specific local mystical traditions, not some kind of broadly understood idea of Islamic art, but really very specific local stories and traditions with the lessons of surrealism. So he's showing us that he's both knowledgeable about what's going on locally, both culturally and politically, and also what is going on in Paris and in other parts of the world, as the surrealist movement was and this is one part where global might be a good word. It was a truly, truly, well, maybe not truly, it wasn't in every place of the globe, but was really widespread in many, many major capitals in the mid-20th century.
So in your fifth chapter, you take a wider temporal view of visual and modern art in Egypt. You trace the arc of the Felaha, or the peasant woman, from the mid-18th century until the mid-20th century. And you ask some of the questions you ask in your book, and I'll just repeat them here. And so you ask, you know, where did she come from? What did her symbol represent? What were the broader implications? How did this symbol, which was originally a colonial image, become so central to Egyptian nationalism? And what consequences did that lead to? What ramifications did it have? And I was wondering if you can briefly share your findings on that, these questions for us. I know it's also another gigantic question, but just to, we can very briefly.
Yeah. So the peasant woman, where did she come from? Well, there's obviously peasant women. There actually were women in Egypt who dressed in this way. And so I also really focus not just on the peasant woman, but this very prevalent image of the peasant woman and a water jug. The shape of the water jug tends to differ throughout the decades and is not always steady, but very often it is a balas water jug, which is this particular kind of very large earthenware jug that is made. The name comes from the place it's made, Daryl Balas, which is near Luxor. So she's often depicted with this very large water jug, which women would use to carry water from the Nile to their homes. So there is that original, actually there were women who looked like this, who had these water jugs. But the image of her comes from colonial travel literature. And so this is a kind of, it comes back to the first chapter in that it charts a way in which this very potent visual imagery and visual symbols get developed through mainly through print, through the distribution of prints and works on paper, kind of the ephemera of the colonial interactions. First, starting out, the earliest representation I could find was in a British travel journal by Richard Dalton in the late 18th century. And then she moves, this image moves as the technologies of image making develop through the decades. She flips from being in engraved prints in books to being in photographs and then in paintings. And she eventually ends up very, very prevalent in Egyptian visual culture, and then as a main symbol in modernist art of Mukhtar, of Said, and then I end with these female Egyptian artists of the 1950s and 60s. So this really, again, shows that constellational modernism and how there really wasn't a stark divide between a European visual culture and a North African visual culture, but a lot of very porous boundaries of production that traveled throughout the region. And that is the history that makes that modernism of the 20th century possible. And then in the book, I argue that the potency of this image comes from anxieties, both colonial and national, around the water resources in Egypt. So the Suez Canal, the Nile, the Mahmoudiya Canal, the ports at Alexandria, that being able to control the flows, the water flows of the region is really key to controlling the resources of Egypt. And so that this image of a woman carrying the water, and that's why it's more important when she's carrying the water jug, because that has it references those waterways. And then I also, through a feminist lens, interpret this rounded water jug as referencing also the powerful flows of female reproduction in menstruation and childbirth and breastfeeding, so that these kind of the powerful flows of the woman are reflected in those powerful waterways of Egypt, and it reflects this anxiety around those resources, and that's what gives her that extra potency that carries her through. And still today, I would occasionally we'll see these sorts of images about Egypt or in Egypt. And it is certainly continues on in visual culture to today.
Thank you for all of that, Alex. And I was wondering, as a final question for our listeners, could you share with us what you're currently working on and what we can look forward to in the future from you?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question that everyone wants to know. So I just finished editing a volume with my colleague, Professor Margaret Graves from the University of Indiana. Indiana University. And that is called Making Modernity in the Islamic Mediterranean. So definitely taking up a lot of the issues from chapter 1, chapter 5 of the book. But we have a really great set of scholars who've contributed articles about the Islamic Mediterranean world and material culture and architecture. And I have an essay in there about the Muhammad Ali Mosque, in which I, instead of seeing the Muhammad Ali Mosque as a the end of the Ottoman tradition. I see it as the beginning of the modernist tradition. So that is something that you guys can look forward to, I guess. So hopefully that will be out next year. And then I'm working on also an article about K.A.C. Creswell, who is an important Islamic architectural historian and has a huge trove of photographs scattered about some really important institutions in the United States, in London, Italy, and Egypt. And for my next book project, I'm aiming to write about art and Islam in America. So that is still at the very early stages, but I am excited to switch focus back to the place in which I'm living for a change.
Well, we're very excited to see the fruits of your work. And once again, Modernism on the Nile, Art in Egypt Between the Islamic and the Contemporary by Alex Dika Segerman. Get your hands on it now. Thank you for joining us, Alex.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you to all of our listeners. Have a great one.